Hey, this is Kate. I'm a forensic psychologist and crisis clinician, and I collect stories. Everything from true crime to trauma to parenthood. There's a lot more in common between depression and sociopathy, or between serial killers and podcasters, than you might think. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss at iwbpodcast.com and iwbpodcast on social media.
Hi, this is Mouse.
I'm Weens.
We have the Mouse and Weens podcast. I'm the mom that lives in suburbia with three kids.
I'm Blalone.
She's the hot Hollywood
cat lady.
And we have a fun podcast where we talk about life, love, and
loneliness.
Pubic hair, come on.
I'm sorry.
We hope you come take a listen to us. We're on all the platforms, and we will see you soon.
I have PMS.
All right. Ready to go?
Yep.
All right. Hello and welcome to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I am Austin Rude. I'm the son.
And I'm Phil Rude. I'm the dad. Every week we watch a movie and then we get on the mic to talk about it.
That's right. And in case you forgot, we are doing the Planet of the Apes trilogy. So
that's right.
This is our second installment.
Should we be calling these Apisodes?
All right, and this is now my solo podcast. Welcome.
You have no room to sling mud or sling poo, as we want to stay on theme.
Seriously, you're gonna
ding me for a pun. You.
That's you. Fair. Okay. I do make a lot of puns.
Yes.
I just, you know, there's a standard that we in the community meet. The pun community.
The pun community? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, so I've culturally appropriated.
That's right. My generation
from the pun community. Your generation? You're making dad jokes. You're making boomer dad jokes, and you're like, my generation's humor. Seriously?
I fought in Nam, okay?
Wow. How
do you know?
Shout out to our Vietnam veterans community, who is going to be sending us hate mail very soon. We're very big with the over 70 crowd.
As long as there's puns in that hate mail, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, well, don't worry, there will be. About how much they hate us.
All right, we're already so far off
track.
We're
way off track, but
have you been up to anything?
I have not really consumed a whole bunch as far as that, you know.
But we're Americans, we consume.
I know. I'm way out of the loop. I actually have not really done very much. There's a Film Crit Hulk video that I watched this week that is breaking down why Mad Max Fury Road works as well as it does.
It's the best movie of all time.
It kind of is right up there with the best movies of all time, but it really does break down why everything works so well. It's really I think it's just a great essay on a film that I love, and that's been, honestly, I don't think I've watched any movies. I don't think I've watched much TV. I've been I've had some freelance work, and I've been working on a personal project, and that's taken up probably most of my time this week. So far as consuming things, no, I really haven't dove into much. I'm pretty boring this week.
Creating and consuming are kind of two different. They're
opposing
things.
Yeah, I'll create a new segment to talk about that stuff. But I haven't really had a lot of time to sit down and I know there's a bunch of stuff that's come out recently. There's a Bob Ross documentary on Netflix that I've been wanting to check out.
I didn't know that.
I think it just came out a couple weeks ago. I don't know. There's a handful of things that I've put on the list, but I just haven't quite made. Ben Rude, my cousin.
I watched his movie.
I did see the final cut of his movie this weekend. I I was a financial supporter of their last push, and part of one of the perks of that was you got early access to it this weekend, over Labor Day weekend. So I did sit down and watch that this weekend. That's been kind of, that was kind of it, that, besides what we watch for the show. So
that's a cool,
it is cool. Bonus. And I was really, really happy to see it. And, I have a bunch of my artwork is in the movie, which is also pretty cool. But Ben, great job. I'm working on possibly getting Ben to sit down and talk with us about making the movie and stuff like that, doing a special episode with Ben.
Dad, as much as I love to have him on the podcast, we're doing trilogies.
Yeah, well,
okay. So unless he makes two more,
you're fired. The movies, the Movers Ultimate cinematic universe kind of thing. Yeah.
That would be really cool to have him on.
That was one of the very few things that I watched this week, and I'm glad that I did. I think Ben did a terrific job with this. It's an independent film. It's a comedy. I'm just trying to think of like the realm of like kind of a bro comedy. Is that what you would call something like The Hangover or
what, like
something like that? It's a lot of dick jokes, a lot of but also like I don't want to sell it short because I think Ben did a really good job of making his characters people, and like there is a little bit more than just the surface level dick jokes that are through that. I don't want to get too much into it, but I think Ben really wrote a movie about people at the same time.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good stuff.
I'm going to have to watch that. Someone didn't tell me when he was playing it. And then I walked in like halfway through.
We could have started it all over again. It was fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm going to play the victim here.
Well, that's fine. You also could have supported Ben's Indiegogo, and you could have got your name in the credits, and you could have had early access to it. And you and your boyfriend could have sat down and watched Movers Ultimate yesterday. But no, you didn't do that, did you?
Let me recover from that burn real quick.
You might want to cut this out of the episode.
Just, a little bit, yeah. Little intense.
Anyway, what have you been up to?
Not much.
End
of conversation.
Okay, moving on.
No, I've watched a few episodes of that animated Harley Quinn show.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's kind of funny, but like I don't stick with it regularly, so I'll just like, if I don't have anything else to watch, I'll just put on a few episodes of that. And that's good, but other than that,
Is it a good show?
It is. I think so.
Is it the one that's like kind of like adult?
Yeah, it's got adult humor, but it's, I don't know. I like it because it's a commentary on like comic books, kind of, because it's like we're rooting for a villain. And so like the villains are kind of comedic. They aren't actually evil, except for the evil ones. And Harley's trying to get into the League of Evil Gentlemen or something, and they're like all about Joker, and I don't know, it's kind of changing her backstory to be like this abuse victim to having her own agency and breaking away from a toxic boyfriend.
All right,
it's an interesting take on the character is what I think.
Okay, well that's cool if you're a Harley Quinn fan, I guess.
Not much into Harley Quinn.
I think Harley Quinn's fine. I just think Harley Quinn was really cool in like Batman the Animated Series, where she was created to be kind of this comic relief character, and you know, not a fully fleshed out, you know what I mean? Like I feel like Harley Quinn has just, it's just sort of like oversaturation. And I just feel like she's become this really overrated character. She's fine.
She did the thing.
Like they've tried to make her
Deadpool too.
Yeah, the hyping, like When we went to Comic-Con, there was like 50% of all of Comic-Con was Deadpool and Harley Quinn cosplay. It's just sort of like, yeah, it just is like, that shows you the level of saturation that it is. And it's just, it's almost like too much. It's like, I think Harley Quinn was like this kind of cool thing because she was a supporting character. And then we did like the most American thing of like, oh, you like this supporting character? Well, now they're the main character of this thing. And it's like, no. What was cool about them is we didn't need, it's like the Boba Fett thing. It's like all of the things right. Where it's like, no, what's cool is that this was just a cool supporting character that kind of stole the show. And now you've given them the show and they have nothing to steal. You've just given it to them. And it's, I don't know. I just feel like Harley Quinn was a good supporting character. And now it's like, oh, Harley Quinn stands for victims' rights. We've sort of turned her into this giant platform for all of these other things that, for me, that was never what she was. She was Joker's crazy girlfriend who hit things with a sledgehammer. Like, that was, I think, what was really, that was what made that character fun. Not all of this other stuff.
See, I come from it, like, I never had that Harley Quinn. Like, that character has never existed to me, because it's, I grew up in the bubble of her being big and popular and me, like, not ever reading any of the material.
Oh, I'm not, like, trying
to... Kind of like Superman. Like, I've never sat down and read a Superman comic.
Right.
But, like, I know about him. That was how I felt about Harley Quinn.
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to take that away from anyone. I'm just saying, like, I don't care about, like, Suicide Squad and all of these things that Harley Quinn is the central focus of, because that's not, to me, what Harley Quinn was. In the Superman realm, same thing. I don't care about Zack Snyder's take on Superman, because I think it's a bullshit take from somebody who doesn't understand anything about who this character is. So, for me, like, that's not any kind of Superman that I think is a good interpretation of the character or well executed. So I just, if you enjoy those movies, good for you, but that's not for me and I'm not going to watch them. So
this is another segment that's going to get us a lot of hate mail.
It's not going to get us a lot of hate mail. Everybody knows I hate Zack Snyder's movies. And
it's not a secret.
No, it's not. I've been very vocal about it for a long time. And Man of Steel was the last bit of goodwill that I gave to Zack Snyder. So, yeah. I mean, that's the thing with legacy characters and characters that are around for a long time is, you know, in 20 years, Harley Quinn will be something else. And you'll be going, oh, I remember when Harley Quinn was this. And I don't like the new take on her. You know what right. I mean? Or
the characters evolve over time.
Yeah. And you just sort of pick out your favorite version. It's why everybody has their fight over who the best Batman is, because there's 10,000 versions of Batman now and they're all a little bit different and everybody can pick out their favorite.
That's true.
Or Planet of the Apes. Everybody has their favorite ape movie to bring us back.
Nice segue.
You like that?
Very, very clever.
It's reinforced when you say nice segue and we stumble.
Let's keep talking about the segue.
It was pretty good.
All right, but yes, this week we are continuing our watch of the Planet of the Apes trilogy with the movie Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I'm just going to call it Dawn because
that's fine.
Title's way too long.
It is a mouthful.
So in Dawn, it's been 10 years since Caesar freed the ape population of Los Angeles. And since then...
San Francisco, but that's fine.
It's a city in California.
What did we say yesterday? If it had been Los Angeles, the apes would be trilingual. They would speak Spanish, English, and sign language.
That's true.
San Francisco, whole different ballgame. Very white city. Where
they're hipsters. They've got Starbucks. All of that.
Very gentrified city. They're all only speaking English.
So yes, Caesar freed the ape population of San Diego.
San Francisco.
All.
They're not all the same.
They're not.
No.
San Francisco?
Yes.
Okay.
Golden Gate Bridge, remember?
I've never been to California.
But you do know where the Golden Gate Bridge is.
They all, yes, but that's the city names blend together. Okay. I've already forgotten it. It's
San Francisco.
Okay.
Where Alcatraz is. And this Alcatraz is... means pelican.
Okay. None of this is helpful. San Francisco. Okay. It's been 10 years since Caesar freed the ape population of San Francisco, and since then, almost all of humanity and their civilizations have been wiped out. But when a human colony is discovered nearby, both groups, the humans and the apes, give into fear, and that leads to... I'm going to start that sentence over. But when a human colony is discovered nearby, both groups' fear of the unknown leads them down a dangerous path.
That is what happens. This movie stars Andy Serkis as Caesar, Toby Cabell as Koba, Nick Thurston as Blue Eyes, Jason Clarke as Malcolm, Gary Oldman as Dreyfus, and a lot of other small roles. I'll also add Kerry Russell. I don't remember her... character name, though. But Kerry Russell is also in this as Malcolm's new wife?
Yeah, girlfriend? I think that's... there's a lot of...
And I mention her because I do like Kerry Russell, and I like when she... She used to be on TV in the 90s. And was a semi-big star of, like, Felicity?
Yeah.
It was, like, the first show that, like, J.J. Abrams was a writer on. It was, like, this WB, which is now the CW. But Kerry Russell was a kind of big TV star in the 90s, and then she kind of went away, and then she just shows up in things like, well, she shows up in a lot of J.J. Abrams stuff, actually, but then she shows up in this, and I just, I think she has a lot of charisma, and I did actually, her character in this movie is, it's like a small role, but I think there's like a little bit of depth to it that she brings, and I do like her and Malcolm's son having a kind of weird relationship, and I think both those actors kind of play that out and give a little bit of something to these people to care about.
Right. This movie has a big ensemble cast, and I think they gave everyone something to do in it. Like, there's no character that's just there. Like, everyone plays a part, even if it's small.
Yeah, I think everyone does play a part. But some of those parts, I think, if we want to just get into talking about cast, I think Gary Oldman is fine. I just think Gary Oldman's character is so flat. Is so such a one-note character.
Yeah, he's kind of like the military leader.
Yeah, and then they're like, we'll give him some depth when he looks at family pictures and cries for 2 minutes. And then that's it. And the rest of the time, it's like they just go, hey, you know how you give like these big yelling speeches as Jim Gordon? Just do that. Because all of this like shouting through a bullhorn, it's like he's reading a motivational speech out of a book. There's nothing to it. I don't feel anything, and I don't think his character is interesting at all, which is a shame because I love Gary Oldman, and I just wish he had been given a little more to do in this movie.
I get what you're saying, but I do feel like in the beginning we get a sense of that he's like this struggling leader that like he's just trying to keep people calm.
I get that that's what he is. I just wish they had not written... I don't feel like this is a Gary Oldman problem. I feel like this is a script problem. It is clear that's what he is. But I don't feel like he's really struggling with any of these choices. I don't feel like he's feeling the weight of it as much. I just feel like it's written so flat. Like, he may as well be wearing a t-shirt that says, I'm the conflicted leader. of the human resistance. Like, there just is not a lot of complexity to his character.
And it's
I think Gary Oldman is capable of... It's almost like this movie kind of wastes Gary Oldman. It's like you signed a great character actor and gave him dick to do. You could have hired anybody to do this role. You know what I mean?
Right. But he did take this role. He saw something in this movie.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not... I mean, I don't know. Maybe it could have been a business decision. I'm not going to speculate on why he took this movie, you know?
Let's email Gary Oldman.
Look, he by this time he'd been in Batman and Harry Potter franchises. He knew what franchises paid to be in a movie. Like, but no, I mean, he may have liked the script. He may have liked the role. But at the end of the day, I don't feel like he brought a lot to this role that it's not a Gary Oldman role. It's just like he was just redoing the Jim Gordon role, I felt like.
Okay. I don't know. I'm conflicted because I see what you're saying.
I think Malcolm actually had a lot of depth and emotion and conflict. And when he approaches where the apes live, you can see that he's afraid and that he is desperate not only to get the power turned on, but to avoid war. I bought all that from that actor. But I also should have been able to buy that from Gary Oldman, other than we need the power, we're going to go kill the apes, or whatever.
We're going to go send you on a quest.
For whatever his bullhorn speech of the day, you know, was. And I don't know, it just came up a little bit short for me.
Okay. I do think some sacrifices had to be made. Because, like, when you compare this to the previous movie... there are more characters, and so you get less time to spend on one character. Like, I feel like, who is he? Malcolm? He is less developed than Caesar's dad. I don't remember his name.
Oh, yeah. Then James Franco.
Like, there's still character there.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, they have less time to focus on those kind of
right. aspects. It's more spread out. But even the with him not having as much screen time or as much attention, I feel like he still was able to give like a nuanced performance, and you got an idea of who this guy was. And even the small roles, like the rest of the people that were over there working on the power plant. You had, what's his name? Carver.
The walking conflict.
The walking anger management. the guy
Andy.
The guy who the guy who basically sets off everything in this movie. You know, because he shoots Ash.
Right, he's the living distrust for...
Yes, he's the guy who never should have been sent on any of these missions. But, like, he's a one-note character, but I feel like there's something obviously beneath the surface of this character. And then the other guy who's with them, I don't even know if they ever say his name. The black guy, the big black dude who's with them.
Yeah.
Like, you get a sense of who that guy is. When he goes and puts Carver in the car and he's like, see you tomorrow, asshole. After he's like, you just blew this for us and put us all in danger.
Right. Like, this is their saving grace. And he kind of knows that.
You understand this guy is desperate too. And they're right on the edge. And he is angry at Carver. He's angry at the situation. Everybody's on edge. And you get a sense of who that guy is. But Gary Oldman, who has more screen time than these other people, I just feel like is this very surface-level character. Again, not Gary Oldman's fault. I just think they didn't flesh that character out in the script.
I see what you're saying. If I were to rank all of the Gary Oldman roles that we've had so far on the picture show, I do think this one would be bottom of the list.
Boy, it has been a few, hasn't it?
It has been.
And this, True Romance.
And
did we see him in something else?
Yeah. What's the Book of Eli?
Oh yeah, Book of Eli.
Right.
Duh. Yeah. And we're gonna see him 3 more times this season.
I know. I picked the Gary Oldman trilogy.
We got the Gary Oldman cinematic universe. It's all coming together. But yeah, I don't want to harp on Gary Oldman. He is in this movie. He does his job, and it's fine.
It's a little bit of wasted screen time or potential.
It is. Yes. When you see like, oh, Gary Oldman's in this movie, it's like, oh, he's actually more interested in, as Sirius Black in movies that I don't give a shit about at all than he is in this movie. But, you know, so it goes.
So overall, like, what did you think going into this movie? Like, were you expecting to not like Gary Oldman's character, or?
What did I think about Gary Oldman?
No, well, just
my expectations for Gary Oldman? Honestly,
did you write
like,
that down before we got in?
Well, I've seen this movie. Are you talking about like way back when I first saw it?
Yeah, I'm just saying, what did you remember of this movie?
Oh, I remembered all the high points. I remembered, I remembered the bullet points of what this movie is and how everything goes down. I enjoy this movie. I'm sitting here harping on Gary Oldman, like, and he's the problem. He's the thing that sinks this whole movie. No, I think this movie's great. I think this is a great follow-up to the original Apes movie. I remember seeing this in the theater because we had seen the first one and loved it so much that I was in on this whole ride, you know, from the get-go. So I guess I probably had high expectations for this movie, and I think it met them. I remember leaving the theater really liking this movie, and I don't think anything's changed. I like this movie, and I like that on repeat viewings, you can still get in there and pick things apart pretty well and kind of understand a little more of the world that's been built and kind of pick up on the smaller details. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I actually very distinctly, I thought I remembered the plot of this movie really well. I didn't. but what I do remember is all of the ape stuff. Like, that really stuck with me. Caesar's story in this movie stuck with me way more than Malcolm and Commissioner Gordon.
Sure. Well, I mean, it is Caesar's story. Like,
it is.
And I think that is the thing that is sticking with me on this rewatch is this is the prequel to Planet of the Apes that explains how we got to where apes become higher evolved and rule the world. But really what this prequel trilogy is Caesar's story. And so it makes sense that he is kind of the central character in this, and he has sort of the most interesting journey, and it's really about his leadership being threatened by kind of the coolest villain in a long time. You know
Koba
what I mean?
Koba is so cool.
Koba is, I don't think it's ever stuck out to me how great of a villain Koba really is. He is a 100% badass in this movie.
He is ruthless. Like, just, you want to root for him as you're watching him.
And you do for a while.
You do. Because, like, can I talk about, like, what I think the metaphor kind of is?
Yeah.
I feel like he is kind of, like, the hate that comes from abuse and trauma. Like, he's seen the bad side of humanity. Caesar's seen the good side of humanity.
Right.
And Caesar thinks that he's above humans, but actually learns that apes are more just like them, because he sees the evil in...
It's a good and bad. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like it's really interesting, the philosophy of this movie.
It's what I think the X-Men is built on that. Charles Xavier wants to live with humanity, and that Magneto wants to destroy humanity.
Because he knows they're afraid of him.
He knows they're afraid of him, and he also is like, we're higher evolved than they are. But it's in the newer versions of the X-Men where Magneto is a Holocaust survivor. He's like driven by this idea of revenge, I think. You know,
he's seen the atrocities.
Right. Humanity is terrible. They are capable of unspeakable things. I'm going to do unspeakable things to them.
He's going to continue the cycle.
Right. But he is going to perpetuate it instead of being a victim of it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think you're spot on, because I think that is what Koba is. Because Caesar's plan is, let them come over here and turn their power on and go away. And if we go show them, look, we can kick the shit out of you. There's hundreds of us. And then, you know, threaten them. But we let them come turn their power on. That'll avoid them coming to conquer us so they can have access to it. And Koba's like, no, we go over there and we destroy it. Like, this idea of these two, neither of them wants to have conflict with humans, but one is like, I'm willing to live on opposite sides of the bridge. And the other one is like, no, no, the way we don't have conflict with them is we kill them all.
Right.
And it is driven by that, what was set up in the first movie, where he's the guy that is, I mean, they show all the scars and he actually points them out in this movie, but in the first movie, they're like, yeah, he's been inside so many labs.
He knows the drill kind of thing.
Right. So he's been tortured basically for his entire life, which is, it makes him you're sympathetic to Koba, I think. And I just, on the surface level, I think he's just cool and he's smart and he is ruthless, and it's kind of fun to watch. And I think the turning point for me, I want to know what yours is too. The turning point for me is when he throws Ash off the balcony, because Ash refuses to kill the man, the human. And he drags him up to the balcony of City Hall and throws him off the balcony.
That's when he's no longer cool.
I think that's the turning point. That's where he goes too far. I know he hits a point before that where he takes it too far, but for me, that's when he loses every bit of sympathy, or any bit of sympathy that I could have had for that character.
I think that scene is meant to do that, because it's also when Blue Eyes, like, he loses faith in Koba as well.
Right.
I think for me, it's when he shoots Caesar, because I think that's supposed to be the big moment where the audience is, because that's really the thing, is Koba goes out of his way to look for humans are bad, humans are going to attack us, to like, he is afraid of them. He's trying to justify that fear. So he goes, he sees that they have weapons. He tries to report it. And then when he's not listened to, he turns from his original message at the beginning of the movie, which is, I'm not going to let them hurt Caesar, to hurting Caesar.
Right.
Like, a human didn't do that. An ape did.
Right.
He became what he didn't want to happen.
Yeah, I I do see that as a big turning point, but I also kind of see that as he's driven by this idea that Caesar is too weak to get it done, and this is a necessary evil of what he feels has to be done. He has to remove Caesar, and he has to frame the humans for it. And that's in part his takeover, but really just part of his agenda to go to war with the humans. So there is like, yes, it's a terrible, terrible thing he does, but I understand his motivation for it. When he throws Ash over the balcony, that's just brutality and anger that Ash is disobeying him. And the idea that he's going to keep the rest of the apes in line by threatening them with the same kind of violence. Like,
right.
You disobey me, this is what happens. And that's straight up tyranny. There's no philosophy. There's no twisted motivation for a greater good in that, no matter how bullshit that is. There's no justification for just being a fascist like that. Like, you do what I tell you or I'm going to kill you. And I think that's the part where Koba, he's already like lost me by that point, but at least he's fun to watch when he's on the horse with two M60s just blast. I mean, there's fun to be had still at that point.
When he's taking over a tank.
Dude, when that guy is trying to crawl out of the tank and gets pulled back in, it's like, oh man, he is tearing shit up in there.
So good.
But yeah, there's fun to be had with Koba after he turns on Caesar. But once they take over, he's imprisoned Maurice and all of the other kind of faithful to Caesar apes, you know, like,
right, kind of after the siege is over,
right?
They're like, okay, this is what him in power is gonna look like.
Yes.
And I think what really does it is when he locks up the supporters, the people who were too loyal to to Caesar. Like, even he kills Ash, and then he immediately imprisons his father because he knows the father isn't going to trust him after he killed his own son.
Right. There's a lot to, I think, all of that where it's like, I'm going to imprison, you know, if you were like to take, if he had taken over the human city and then been like, you can join my army except for you who were too loyal to the old human leader, it's almost like understandable because like that was your enemy, but these were part of his community, you know what I mean? And
right,
just saying, like,
turning on your own,
you're part of the old administration who I said we were going to avenge him, but you're too loyal to him, so I'm gonna lock you up. And that's I think a really telling part. And Maurice looks so sad in those chains. Oh,
I know,
man. Poor Maurice.
He put education in chains.
That's right. He did. Don't think for yourself. It is the fascist rule.
It is.
You know.
I wonder, you know, there's that list of everything that defines fascism. There's like 12 bullet points.
Yeah.
Wonder if Kubo follows that.
He does. He's like, all right, first thing I got to do is take out the Board of Education. And then like Betsy DeVos comes in. He's like, this is who's in charge of your school now, apes.
Oh, God.
But,
can we talk about the world building here?
Yes,
because I feel like this movie has an insanely different feel to the last movie. Granted, there's been 10 years in this world.
Sure, society's fallen in this time,
and I really like that the last movie ends with the beginning of the fall. And then this kind of picks up in the same sequence,
right,
showing the aftermath of everything. But this movie just has an apocalyptic look to it. And I think that's because of this movie brings a new director, Matt Reeves.
Matt Reeves, yeah.
And what he does is really interesting because the human, like, you really see the overgrown city, the low resources, kind of like scraping things together. It's what you would see in any The World Has Ended TV show or movie.
Yeah. It looks like the TV show Life After People. Do you remember that show?
I loved that show.
Yeah, I did too. But it was like, yeah, once that happens, plants are going to take over buildings and that's totally what is going on here. It's...
Right. But then that's juxtaposed with the apes, who are living this tribal sort of life, where they have sculptures, they have face paint and jewelry, right, and ways of hunting, and they're able to survive on their own.
They're looking
scraps.
They look more like what we would picture indigenous tribes to look like. And I think they're doing it without, like, stereotyping indigenous tribes. It's just sort of like this sort of this primal kind of thing. When they're hunting and they have, like, skeletons painted on them.
Right.
It's so cool. And then, like, the little city they have built up. There is a decor to it. There is, like, there is a culture around these apes.
Right. They're forming their own culture in just 10 years.
Yeah.
Which is insane. And then they have, I think my favorite shot is Maurice and the little apes with the whiteboards. And they're writing letters A,
right,
B, C. And then he's teaching them apes don't kill other apes.
There's like the commandments are kind of written there, Animal Farm style. You know, the apes strong, apes together strong, apes are not to harm other apes, whatever, you know, up,
right,
up on the wall. It is just sort of like their rules of society kind of thing.
It's just so interesting to see that.
It is. A side note here, I'm looking at Matt Reeves. Matt Reeves is listed as a creator of Felicity. So there's the Carrie Russell connection there. She made some powerful friends on that show, and it's paying off for her. But he was also the director of Cloverfield, of the first Cloverfield movie.
The original.
Yeah, the found footage Cloverfield movie. But he did, yeah, he did the second two Apes movies.
So this movie should be a lot more shaky cam.
Boy, you would think it would be. Caesar, I'm so glad. Around. I'm so glad it wasn't. But sorry for the tangent, but yeah, I think they do a really good job of showing the apes just having a society, and also showing the humans having a new society. And both are primitive. One is happy, and it's sort of like a utopian primitive society. And the other one is this disgruntled, oh my God, we're almost out of fuel. What will we do without electricity? How will we, you know, like, they're really starting to lose their shit.
Well, that's
over just having, not even having their food supply cut off. They're is just about having power. And it just kind of shows you, like, yeah, if the world went dark, humanity probably would lose out to nature eventually, because we have almost devolved in that survivalist kind of way.
Listen, I love and respect nature. I don't know how to pitch a tent. I don't know how to
build a fire.
Build a fire, exactly. None of that. I would die in the apocalypse without power and heat.
Oh, it no. Does. Yeah. It. Look, I sit here and I know I'm coming off like humanity's a bunch of pussies, but like, no, seriously, like I live indoors too. I don't want this to happen, but yeah. I think it does a great job of showing those two, and they're, you know, obvious symbolism, yes. They're on opposite sides of a bridge. There's a big gulf between them, you know, like I get it.
One is on the rise, one is on the fall.
Right. It's they're kind of passing each other, and this movie is the turning point for those two things.
It is. I think each movie in this trilogy, like, it's very cut and dry. Like, the first one, humans are above apes. This one, they're even, but they're going up versus down. And the next one, apes are above
apes humans. are running the show, basically. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it happens as kind of as Caesar makes a tough decision, just like in the first movie, we see Caesar trying to not kill people, and then he is driven to it. At the end, he makes the decision, you know, kill this guy.
Protect yourself.
And in this one, the big thing, like we just talked about, like apes do not kill other apes. At the end of the movie, he has to make the decision, and he has to kill Koba.
And he says, you are not
an ape. You are not an ape. He's cleaning up his ranks now. Like, okay, if we're going to have a society, we can't have rogue apes, basically. Just like, you know.
Right.
And it's what brings them out of being primitive into the society, I think, that we're going to see in the third movie. I don't know, but...
He basically has to kill off the hate.
He does. He has to... You can't have criminals in their society. You know, like, it is an idea of... He has to make a tough decision based on what his moral compass is. His moral compass is apes together no matter what. And now he's realizing, I think Caesar is a good leader because at a certain point he realizes there is no hard and fast rule for anything. And he has to make a decision. And it's a hard decision, but he does it.
Right. I don't know how to describe it. It's like he's trying to keep the ranks there. So he knows that if there are rogue apes, there's going to be a civil war.
Right.
And he's trying to prevent that.
He has to keep them together. Because, I mean, before apes don't harm other apes, I think their first rule was apes together strong. So if there's a split, yes, there's not going to be that. And I think that it all comes together. And it happens at the same point in the movie, at the end of the third act fight scene, which, again, just like the first movie, great third act fight scene here. Like, it doesn't burn itself out with the big one in the middle. It gives you a great fight scene at the end on that scaffolding, all around that building under construction. It's brilliant.
And Malcolm's standoff.
Malcolm, that
is honestly my favorite part of this
Malcolm movie. Was in the middle.
Wow. I get that.
Was he not in the middle?
He was.
What if they had named this movie Planet of the Apes 2, Malcolm in the middle.
Okay, so I get it. I took off starting the show, so you have to take my role interrupting with
Batman. Oh, wow. It's just like the way apes and people are switching their roles in society, you and I.
Look at that.
This is the second installment of you running the show. Like, yep. It's going to happen.
By the next one,
it'll be
you'll be unruly.
War for the Planet of the Picture Show.
We have a whole planet now?
Yes. Yes, we do. It's very sparsely populated.
It's this one studio.
That's right. But yeah, I do have in my notes the that you pointed out in getting back to talking about ape culture as it's presented in this movie. The skulls, there's like skulls on sticks and shit like that. And I think that is part of like their cultural thing. And that carries through to, original Planet of the Apes film where there are like scarecrows or right. scarecrow
warning type, symbols.
Things in like the Forbidden Zone. That is to let apes know you don't go here. Like this is.
Right.
But again, that's based on tyranny and ignorance, like keeping the population ignorant to what is they're hiding something out there. But it does start here. And I like that that is the kind of thing, as opposed to the blatant fan service in the last movie. This is sort of, it's not fan service. It is in service of the original vision. It is all sort of. This is where the seed is planted.
Right, you can kind of see the way becomes that society.
Absolutely.
Are there any direct references, like line for line, in this movie?
I didn't catch any. Like, it was not like the last one. It could be, but again, I think the big one is Maurice. I did look up the actor's name. Maurice Evans played Dr. Zaius in the original Planet of the Apes, and that is why Maurice the orangutan is named Maurice.
Right. I believe a woman plays him in.
Oh, really?
This. I think when I was looking up the cast, I saw that.
Well, that's pretty cool.
I don't know if it's voice or...
Yes, Karen Connival. Connival. It looks like a character actor. She played Maurice in all three. She's been in the X-Files. She's been in the Snowpiercer TV show. Oh, yeah, she...
Interesting.
She does a lot. The Good Doctor, a.k.a. the Robot Doctor.
Beep, pop, boop.
I am a doctor with autism, and autistic people speak like robots.
It's so...
yeah, that's my imitation of the portrayal of autistic people on the show The Good Doctor. That is not what I think about autistic people.
Just to be clear.
To clear that up, yes. Supergirl, Charmed, the new Twilight Zone.
She's in a lot.
She works, yeah. Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Yeah, that's cool. I did not realize. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you don't think about it, but it's like, oh, it's all mocap. Why couldn't a woman play a male ape or vice versa? It's right. Not like...
I think he says one line actually spoken.
He tells her, like, tells the people to run. Run. Yeah. Yeah. Man, I do love Maurice. I think Maurice is such great.
Reading the book with the Sun character.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're reading comics together.
There's a lot of small, like, just warm moments with that group.
Yeah, you do see, like, the sort of elder statesmen of the apes, like Rocket and Koba. I'm trying to think who they all were. There's Caesar and his wife, who really doesn't do a whole lot except be kind of sick and need to be...
Be a plot point, basically.
Kind of, yeah. And Maurice. Basically, all the apes that were in the animal shelter in the first one.
They're kind of the council of
You
this.
Do kind of... Right. You see them as sort of like the group at the top. And that's where the split in how to lead the apes is. And the ones who do side with Caesar are the more level-headed ones, like Maurice and Rocket, and they're sort of like a tighter group. They're level-headed, they're smarter, they want more peaceful things. And I think it's great in characters that don't speak audibly. There's a lot of sign language. But even without the sign language, I think there's just a lot of in how the characters behave and how they react to things. And that comes across in the performances of the mocap actors. Andy Serkis, we all know, is fantastic at mocap stuff. But a lot of these actors, you just see the way they react to things and the way they move around. And so much of the performance is in that. And I think it's great.
There's one specific scene where it just hit me. I'm looking at entirely CGI because it was...
Yeah.
The apes were all on horses. I think it was Caesar, Maurice, and Blue Eyes. It's when they're at the dam. Like, they row right. horses to yep. get there, and there's just one shot of all of them in a row on horses. And it didn't look like CGI, but I was just like,
yeah.
This is entirely fake, and I don't believe that.
There were a couple points in there where I'm looking at chimpanzees, and because we have chimpanzees in the real world, you're like, oh, are these... I mean, they look real. Like Caesar's, if you look at his face, you see where individual hairs are, where his hairline starts. I apologize yeah. for the landscaping going on in the background right now.
We're just going to hope that doesn't
coming across. But there's a texture to Caesar's skin. There's all of this stuff that makes it look so real that you think, oh, they have a trained chimp playing this.
Right.
And then you have to go, oh, no, it's not a trained chimp. This is motion capture, and it looks brilliant.
Right. I think what also stands out is, again, Maurice, his face shape Orangutans have a really weird face shape.
They have that,
and it the almost cheek, juts
the
out
cheek pouches. It's part of the thing that when they get old, they get these round, leathery faces.
Right. I just something about that felt like I could touch it and
feel the texture of it. Yes, absolutely. I think the CGI in this is I know it's not seamless in this other movie I'm going to reference, but where they get it right, they get it really right, and that's the Peter Jackson King Kong, where you're looking at a gorilla and you see the wind blow through his hair, and you see it react correctly, and you see all these things. And I think they do a great job here. I think part of it is like they shoot the chimps a lot and the apes a lot in like lower light, so. It's not a cop-out. It just helps. It helps make it more seamless.
Not as much rendering and like stuff like that.
It doesn't look like it's cut out like on the edge. You know, it helps it blend into the scenery a little more. And I just think the whole thing is really great. I think it really looks good. And
well, there's 3 years between each movie in this trilogy, and like really, there's not much change in the CGI. Like, it looks amazing from the first movie to the third movie. I would say the first one is a little rough around the edges in, like, two or three scenes.
At certain points, yeah.
Right. But, like, other than that, like, it is remarkable what they do.
I think in the first one, we talked about this, the roughest parts of it are where they're not doing motion capture, where they're just doing a CGI. Like, when he's climbing through the trees,
right,
or running through the house and climbing on things. That's it's not Andy Serkis. That's all just animated CGI chimp. And I think those are the roughest part, and I think that shows you how important the motion capture performances are. And there's been a lot of talk in the last few years about, like, do we include motion capture as eligible for like best actor or best actress Oscars? You know, like, award shows are not sure what to do with motion capture. They're like, is it a real performance? Is it not a real performance? And
it's very much people, a real performance.
Right. People who do this and people who understand how CGI works are trying to tell people, this is a performance. This isn't a computer doing the work. You know, it's like saying that, oh, Heath Ledger as the Joker had makeup on. Therefore, He's not doing the acting. He's not doing the performance. The makeup is what makes him the Joker. Like, it's this weird sort of denial of the art form that they're doing.
At the very least, a separate category.
I think there's been talk about that, but
I do think it's on par with just put them up for best supporting actor, best actress.
It's a weird thing, because it's almost like, do we subcategorize it so that, you know, so that they're not going against people who are doing every part of their performance, you know what I mean? It's like the way that there's a best animated film, where I'm at a point now where I'm sort of like, why couldn't Soul be nominated for best picture? Why does it have to be subjugated to best animated picture? It's like, this was a better movie than 90% of the live action movies that came out this year.
Movies,
you know,
have changed so much, right, that the categories are weird. I feel like there should also be one for stunt actors.
Oh, yeah.
Because they need more recognition, and there's a lot of really cool stunts that are pulled off in modern movies. Like, I feel like action movies are trying to one-up, like, oh, we're going to have James Bond jump from a helicopter to another helicopter.
Right.
Or something.
I'm going to shout out a podcast, not as a regular part of the shout-outs, but it is a podcast called Women Kick Ass, produced by my buddy Hammond Chamberlain. And this is a podcast that highlights female stunt performers and who do a lot of work. Zoe Bell has been on there, and Zoe Bell has done a lot of work with like Quentin Tarantino. She was in Death Proof. I think she does the big centerpiece stunt of like standing on the car.
Okay.
In Death Proof. And she's in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in just a freaking hilarious scene. She's on there, not as a stunt performer, but as someone who's in charge of the stunt performer. And it's just like, she's in the Bruce Lee scene, and it is the funniest thing. Her react, she's so good in it. So
she's a stunt performer that played a character
that also plays stunt performer. Yes. But yeah, if you are interested in recognition for stunt work and any of that, it's a really unique take on it because stunts, I think, used to be largely performed by men wearing wigs to be like female stand-ins. And now it's like, no, there's a whole world of women who do stunt work. And right. It's really great. So check that out. And Hammond has also featured a lot of these women on Beyond the Playlist, his regular interview show. So Hammond is a great window into the world of stunt work, honestly.
That's
just
cool.
Because he knows a lot of these people and has sort of gotten to know this world through the Artemis Film Festival, which highlights like female-led action movies and things like that.
I think with stunt work especially, it's easy to forget about because if they do their job well, you don't know they're there.
You don't notice it, right. It looks correct. I think it's also one of those things that if something looks really dangerous, people assume it's CGI now. And
that's
I think
true.
A lot of it is, but I still think there's a lot of practical people like Christopher Nolan do so much practical stunt work. You know what I mean? Like there still are directors who are like, I want to do this for real.
I wonder how much of Dunkirk was real stunt work.
I would bet a lot of it. Christopher Nolan does a lot. He does CGI stuff, but he does a lot of stuff.
He does a mix. I feel like.
What was the word I was looking for? Jeez. Hi, Monday. He uses a lot of extras. He does a lot of stuff practically. If you ever watch his behind-the-scenes stuff, you know, they'll show you, like, this is how we flipped this truck over. This is how we built this. Even, like, Inception. Like, they rotated rooms and had Joseph Gordon-Levitt running up the wall and stuff
right.
like that. Like, he really likes to do that stuff for real. So, there is still a big world full of stunt work. And I'm sorry for that huge tangent. But if anyone is interested in it, and in particular, female stunt work, check out Women Kick Ass. It's a podcast. It might be on, I don't know if they're on hiatus right now or not, but it's a huge back catalog. Go check it out.
Right. And as far as tangents go, we can't hide our nature.
That's what we do.
This is the tangent show, really.
We also watched a movie this week.
we pick a movie to be our starting point, and then we spiral. But if we do want to talk about Dawn more, there is the aspect of, I think this is a war movie. This is a movie about warfare. I think it highlights the atrocities of war very well. I feel like a lot of the character arcs, like especially Blue Eyes, his kind of radicalization.
Right.
Like all of this, it's just a really good war movie. It really explains war really well, I think.
I think war is the backdrop of this movie. But I think the bigger point is not the atrocities of war. You said it in the radicalization of Blue Eyes, which I think is done really well. I think this movie is about extremists. That Koba is an extremist. His heart's in the right place. He wants to keep apes safe. But the way he goes about doing it is so, so extreme. And the same thing, I think it isn't shown as well, but that is Gary Oldman's character. And that is Carver. You know, these people who are anti-ape to the point where war is their solution to it as well. Like, this is about extreme ideologies, whether or not it's well-intentioned or not, and what it does to people. It sort of sweeps people up. I think there could have been a really interesting parallel in Malcolm's son getting kind of swept into the war machine of the people.
Like, because there was a scene where he was listening to the other guys around the fire. Like, the guy who blamed apes for everything.
Right.
And the other guy talking about how they're all just wild animals. Like, that could have been a really interesting subplot.
The way that Blue Eyes gets sort of swept away from his father into Koba's mindset. It could have happened on the other end. Like, there's a scene where they're getting ready to fight the apes are coming. And Gary Oldman goes over and there's that young kid who looks real nervous.
And he helps him.
And he's like, come on, buck up. And then, like, the next time we see that kid, he's dead. But it's like, I don't know who that kid is. I have no connection to him. You showed us him for 10 seconds before. And now I'm supposed to care that he died. Yes, he's young. But I don't know what that kid's journey was. You show me a journey of a kid getting swept up in this side of the radicalization, this side of the extremism. Then I'll feel bad for that kid for getting killed over somebody else's extremism. You know what I mean? Like,
I have a different take. Like, I thought that that was such a good, like, shot when they just pan over to the
dead kid. Oh, it was a good shot. Kid. Yeah.
Like, because I thought precisely because we don't know a lot about him. Like, the only interaction we had with this kid is him being scared and him fighting because he thinks it's this or nothing. It's like a tragedy of what could have been. Kid could have had a life. He could have done so much.
I just think it would have paralleled the Blue Eyes story really well. Here it is on this side, and here it is on this side. And don't you feel bad for both of these kids who have been basically brainwashed and swept into the jingoism of their respective sides? They're fighting for something that they don't necessarily believe in, but they've been told they do. Right. And this sort of there's your war movie aspect of they're showing you the carnage of war and the senseless violence of war in showing that dead kid. But I don't have a connection to that dead kid. For all I know, that dead kid hated apes too. You know? Or maybe he was indifferent about apes, but they were like, you have to do this for people, and they put a rifle in his hand. And then I feel bad for that kid. But I really don't know. I don't know anything about him. The people are just faceless people, basically, in this movie, except for the four or five that we spend time with.
Yeah, you know what? I'll give that to you. I'll accept that criticism.
I don't think it's giving or taking. I don't think there's... I'm telling you that's my interpretation of it. I think your interpretation is valid because that's what you saw in it.
But I do see your interpretation now. Like, it makes sense to me.
I think this movie could have been a lot more about the kind of a metaphor for, like, nationalism, you know, like this idea of go to war for your country because it's the right thing to do, you know.
Well, they did kind of have like a little, that guy blames the apes for the virus that wiped out humanity, and then the wife doctor character is like, you're really gonna blame them for what was forced on them?
They were experimented on,
right? Yeah. But they even do that in the name of it. So, like, there's almost like this subtle backstory of, like, the media was blaming
about a prejudice against
this flu, the ape flu. I don't remember what
the
they called
simian
it.
Flu is what they call it.
Okay,
yeah, yeah. And even, like, Carver is like, spare me your hippie bullshit. It's like, well, that's not hippie bullshit. That's what happened. Like, people injected this into, like, it's not their fault they became smarter, you know?
Right.
Like, but it's, yeah, it's a weird, there is a weird balance here, and I feel like it hits all of these points, or touches on all of these points, but doesn't necessarily hang with them all for very long. And in some cases, I think it hangs with them enough, and in some cases, I think it could have stood to put a little more focus on some of these points.
Sure. They could have developed a lot.
It's a minor criticism. More. I don't think it hurts the movie and what the movie is getting at, but
I do think this movie is very fast paced. It doesn't stick with the scene or a subject or topic for long.
I think there's a couple points where it does slow way down. When Caesar is wounded and they take him to where his house
childhood
was.
Home.
Yes. I think there's a lot of slowness in those scenes in the house. But they cut. They're necessary. I get why they're there. And also when they're working on the dam. And I think there's a lot of just watching people work. And it's just kind of like.
See, I felt like the dam story went very fast.
As a whole, it did. But I think there's a couple scenes in there that just sort of go on a little bit. Just a hair longer than they needed to. But I get why they're there. It just throws the pacing off a little bit. But for the most part, I think you're right. I think this movie keeps moving and especially like the last act of it, like it's pretty relentless, really.
It is.
I just want to talk about the final scene in this movie when basically Caesar comes down to the lobby and meets all the apes. It's very church-like. He has a very, like, Jesus Christ metaphor there. He's on the altar of the church, basically, and all the apes are coming to rejoin him. He is basically risen from the dead. I don't know if it's been 3 days. I hadn't thought about that until just now.
I do think there's a lot of Jesus, Adam, Julius Caesar. There's a lot of, this is a historical figure. Is kind of how they paint Caesar.
He is seen as a savior. And he comes back and they come to follow him again. And the way the light is in that big open lobby, it looks like a church or like a temple or something where he is at the head of it.
For some reason, it reminds me of a train station.
There's train tracks underneath there. I don't know what that building is.
But it does look very, like...
Right, it's big, open.
He's glowing.
Right.
It's and golden hour or something.
Malcolm, at the same time, is walking back into the shadows. Man is being eclipsed by this big... It's all the symbolism is right there. It's kind of slapping you across the face, but I think it works. I don't think obvious metaphor is a bad thing. I think this movie communicated exactly what it wanted to, and they wanted to make sure... You understood what was going on. And I think that last shot, I think it's beautiful. I'm not calling it out as a criticism. It is a obvious Jesus in church metaphor, and I think it works really, really well.
It also sets up for the next chapter. They kind of know what they're up against.
Right.
Humanity's last hurrah basically is coming.
Yeah.
And then what I really love is when he tells Malcolm to go.
Yeah.
And then we see the shot of Malcolm looking back. And then we, as Caesar, look back. And it's just the empty doorway.
He's gone. Yeah. That's, I think, the tragedy of this movie. Is Caesar knows he has to go to war with people now. And he doesn't want to.
What he's been trying to prevent, he can no longer.
He's been forced into it. And I think this series amps it up each time. And I think that's what's so great about it, is this gives a CGI ape so much depth of character It's really, it's super impressive, man. It really is. You understand how sad Caesar is at the end of this movie. Like, he's had to kill other apes.
He had to kill someone who he thought was his friend.
Who had been with him since the very beginning. And he's had to do this. And this friend he made in Malcolm, or at least this mutual respect, he's like, we're on opposite sides now, you know? And he says, I had hope for us. And he says, I did too. And it's like, that's really, really sad when you come down to it. They had hoped to live together, and they're like, nope, one of us has to go now, and this is going to be horrible.
And he's also kind of saying bye to James Franco.
Right.
Because he's like, he says, this was a great man, just like you are a great man, or something.
Right. That the good stuff he saw in humanity, he knows doesn't count for anything anymore.
Right.
That he's like, well, they're just going to be my enemy. I know how good they can be, but doesn't even apply
anymore. That's not them.
So, yeah, really wild.
It is.
What else you got, bud?
Honestly, I don't know. I feel like I could talk about the world building of this series all day.
There's a lot.
We have covered the main bits. I think a few shots really stand out in my head, or like moments, like when the ape's original home is burning,
and oh, yeah.
Blue Eyes takes Koba's hand. Like just that scene is very striking. And also, like the smaller moments, like Caesar's new son playing with Malcolm's family. Like, remember, yeah. he runs away and then right. he's playing
the
with
little
her
baby
hair
chimp, and yeah, before Carver freaks out on it and becomes like a baby abuser and an animal abuser all at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's terrible. And they should have let Caesar cave in his head right there.
Oh, like, yeah. That's like, your way of keeping peace. Yeah. This
like,
guy
here,
tried to kill your son.
We'll okay. give you him and have that be it. But yeah, it's so, it's such a weird, decision to go. Yeah, the guy with the shortest fuse possible, we're going to send him into this real volatile situation where
right.
peace is so fragile and kind of in the balance. Also, he shot an ape already. Also, he's going to sneak guns in there, directly disobeying the one condition right. of us being there.
Oh, and it's then just... we're going to place him in a car. I fully expected him to climb out of that car and fuck up something else.
Dude, when Koba drags him out of the car, it's so good. It's
it
so good. He just kind of appears, and then he just drags it through the window. It's so good.
One thing man. I will say.
Koba, so you rule.
You talked in Rise of the Planet of the Apes about how that end battle works so well, because this movie has kind of been, like, giving you arguments for why these apes should be free the whole movie.
Right.
And this, again, continues that streak of, like, it really emotionally invests you in the fight and in the conflict, because all of these things, like, you know, Koba is wrong, and you know Caesar is trying to keep this together. Like, each scene really adds to why you should be on Caesar's side, or, like,
right.
how the conflict is playing out. Like, it really engages
everything. It's all in service of the long game. And so far, it's also in service of the bigger story being told across movies.
Right. But there's no sacrificing one movie for that.
Right.
Like, this isn't a plot movie to get from the first
right.
movie to the
it's
third.
It's not
movie.
Filler. It's a chapter in the series.
The way it should be.
Right. It's not Ant-Man. Yeah, I said
oh,
it.
Oh, wow.
I said it. It's not the first Avenger. It's not Iron Man 2. Should I keep going?
I think we get the point.
Yeah.
All right.
You're looking at me like you disagree with me.
I just don't know why you went for Ant-Man specifically.
Because Ant-Man's so boring.
I think you just think that because you want Edgar Wright to have made it.
I do want Edgar Wright to have made it because it would have been interesting and not boring then.
I don't think it was boring. I just don't think it was
great. I think it's formulaic and therefore boring. It's the same Marvel Origins story we've seen 100 times. They just plug in a different costume.
But this time it's a sarcastic white man? Oh, wait.
We're going to hire Edgar Wright to do it. Oh, cool. I'm going to make it this way. It's like, oh, that's a little Edgar Wright of you. We don't want you to do that.
They learned with Taika Waititi.
Did they?
I think they did. I think he's doing what he wants.
I think he is, sure.
Yeah. And he's getting away with it. They didn't pull him off the movie. Anyway. Spiraling into another
tangent. Agree to disagree. I'm off the MCU train anyway, so I don't really care what they do now.
You don't get a say then.
I can criticize what I've seen.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all I did.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Your episode. Where are we going?
Let's do shoutouts. What do you have this week?
I am going to shout out, and I'll have to dig up the link on it. There is an episode of a podcast called The Dollop. That I am going to shout out because it sort of relates to these movies. This is a this is a episode about Project NIMH. There's also a documentary called Project NIMH about the same thing. It is about a group of hippies in the 60s who basically had an experiment to raise a baby chimpanzee as a human child to see what would happen. These people had no scientific background. They had no animal care expertise. They basically just raised it in a brownstone in New York City, I think.
I have heard of this story before. It goes perfectly well, right?
Yep. Nothing. It actually fits very much into the Planet of the Apes series about why this is a horrible idea.
Is this the one where they also had children?
They did have children, yes, and they just
children started mimicking the ape or something, and they canceled the experiment.
They canceled the experiment because the ape, as the girlfriend in the first one said, soon he will become a very powerful wild animal because that's what a chimpanzee is, and yes. The chimp became very aggressive towards one of the people involved. Anyway, The Dollop is Dave Anthony and Gareth Reynolds. They're both comedians. One of them reads a story, typically American history story, and the other one is listening blind to them read the story, and they just react to it in improv comedy jokes and stuff about it.
Okay.
And this one, I think Gareth reads this one. Usually Dave reads it, but they call it a reverse dollop. But it's really, really good. It's a really interesting story. The documentary called Project NIMH is out there. If you are interested in it, I recommend listening to the Dollop podcast about it and watching the documentary. But I will link the Dollop. It's a super interesting story, and it's very funny at the same time. And I think it fits right in with in an abstract kind of way with the Planet of the Apes series we're doing.
That's so interesting. Please, people, for the love of God, stop.
It's a very different time.
Stop owning exotic animals.
It was a different time in American academia, I think. I think it was kind of an experimental time because one of the people was, at least one of them was like a college professor or an anthropology professor, something.
Okay. I thought they were completely untrained.
Or maybe a behavioral. No, somebody was, there was college involvement somewhere in this, but there's a lot of sort of hippie experimental learning kind of, oh, what would happen if we I think they were trying to answer a nurture versus nature question. If we raised a chimp as a person, would it grow into basically being a person? And like, it's a ridiculous idea when you, I mean,
right.
but they're just like, what if it, has anyone tried it? Let's try it because no one ever has. And they probably got some huge grant money for it. I don't know. But check it out. It's really, really interesting.
Well, that experiment failed, but have we tried giving it drugs?
I guarantee you someone has given a chimpanzee drugs. As a matter of fact, I know there have, because I have a book over there about primates, and there's a photograph of a chimpanzee in there, and the caption is like, oh, this chimp was rescued, it was crack addicted, it was like this, you know, it belonged to, I don't remember who, but yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
People do horrible things. Belongs
to the DARE program. This is what happens when you
this is your brain
marijuana.
On drugs, and they just let a chimp loose in a school. He's high on crack. He's stealing everybody's stereo out of their car.
This is totally a drill. Perfectly harmless.
All right. That's me, the dollop. What do you got?
The dollop. Okay. I am shouting out a YouTube channel called Crime Pays But Botany Doesn't. It's really hard to explain, but this guy, he's a Chicago Italian with like a thick accent, very,
hey!
Very like softly angry all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs a comedic education channel where he basically just takes you on like a 30-minute tour of native plant and animal life in his area, which is not Chicago. He's moved somewhere, but he has the accent, or he fakes the accent. I don't know, it could be part of a gimmick, but yeah, it's really interesting. It's kind of captivating. They're like these 30 minute sometimes 15 minute videos, and he also hates city landscaping because oftentimes there's no thought mm-hmm. about what plants go together or what's healthy. So he does something which is technically illegal and just plants better trees yeah. in their place. And then that's part of his job. And so he sells merch that says crime pays, but botany doesn't.
Okay.
And like unofficial forestry agent. It's a whole thing,
yeah.
But it's very fun.
Is that shirt you have?
Yeah, I have one of his shirts.
Yeah. That's really interesting because I have seen some TikTok videos and some articles about how basically grass is this giant industry and everybody has a grass lawn, but nobody should. Like, it's not really native to most places that have it.
We grow more grass in North America than...
Right.
Food to eat.
And people have shown, like, look, I've uprooted all my turf and I've planted native vegetables or native plants. And basically they turn their entire lot, save for their house, into a garden.
Right.
And they're like, you know, twice a year we come out and we harvest this and then we'll plant something else. And then, you know, and we rotate it. Through. It's really, really interesting, and it makes me really curious about the possibility of doing this, the amount of water that we spend keeping grass alive in places where...
In Florida?
Where it shouldn't be,
like,
you know, like...
Right.
We're trying to keep this alive. It's like, you know how we joke about how, like, we should go out and just shoot the last pandas because we think it's a mistake that they're alive? We're not really going to shoot pandas. But
he won't. Someone has to have the balls here.
Go ahead and shoot them. I strangle them with my bare hands. Because
bare hands?
I'd like to see the light go out in their eyes. No, there's like a line of thought, and I think it started as a joke, but it really makes sense when you think about it. Like the idea that pandas only exist in this one little area of the world. They eat bamboo. They have no predators, they have no prey animals, they're not really keeping anything in balance, they have a hard time mating them, they have a hard time getting them to, it's almost like they're this mistake that won't quite they should have gone extinct, but by some loophole, they've stayed alive. And no. I feel like that's kind of what grass in Florida and a lot of the Southwest, it's like, we spend so many resources keeping this thing that shouldn't even be here alive. I'm going to check this YouTube channel out because it sounds like more of that. And
it is that. And
I'm curious about turning our lawn into something, you know, native as
right.
opposed to...
Even if it's just like...
And driving all my garden. Neighbors insane.
Look, there are ways to do it where it won't like... grow insane amounts, like where you don't have to do as much upkeep.
Right, but everybody wants the manicured lawn, especially in suburbia right. here. Like well, that's the thing you're judged by is what your freaking lawn looks like.
That's the ideal that's been since like the 1800s
right, right.
of like you're rich, you own a lawn of grass.
That's it. I that's one of the videos I saw just yesterday was like the reason we have lawns is because it was a flex for rich people to say, I can afford this exotic plant to cover all of my ground, and I can afford to have people to maintain it. Like, right. it was all about, like, it was like this excessive thing. It was like a McMansion of the day that
right.
it was just there to show how much money they had.
And another thing that this account talks about a lot is... an issue with modern landscaping is that there are too many pollinators used in big cities. This is why people, oh, I have a pollen allergy. Everyone's allergic to dust and pollen, but some people are more sensitive to it. And in nature, there are trees that produce pollen, and then there are trees that like kind of absorb the pollen, and they yeah. use it to make fruit. So like things like apple trees and other things of that nature, they would be absorbing those pollen in a normal environment, and they don't in the cities because cities don't plant
the ones
trees
that,
like
bring
that.
It in. Oh, wow.
Right. So really it's just like an excess of pollen because we don't plant the right plants.
This has been a great science lesson to cap off our great ape discussion.
Right?
Yeah. I like this.
It's not ape science, but
no
plant science.
No, it's not, but you know what? It works.
It does.
I'll allow it.
We're kind of on theme.
All right, good call. Good shout out.
Thank you.
What is that channel called? Just one more time. Crime pays, but botany doesn't.
Crime pays, but botany doesn't.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Check that out, people. On that note, we want to thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility, and it helps us grow the show.
That's right. And another way to help us grow is to tell a friend. I know it's a little hard when, you know, there's no dam powering your electricity. You can't send out an email.
That's right.
But go door to door. Just beware of big groups of apes trying to stop you from bringing the message that is listen to the picture.
Actually, you know what? I would say tell those apes. I think we're a pro ape show. I think they would enjoy our show.
You know what? Apes, please listen in.
If you're an ape who listens to our show, please leave us a review. That really will help our popularity in the ape community.
It will. Or, you know, tweet us.
We are pro-ape. We are anti-panda, though. So if you are a panda listening to our show, please stop.
Please stop.
Please stop. And
if you're
and
funding
die.
Panda...
Yeah.
Panda research, why?
Yeah, WWF, we're on to you. Your little panda bear logo. You're just perpetuating a species that should be extinct.
Listen, bugs are way more relevant to the ecosystem
yeah.
worldwide.
We're pro-B.
Pro-B.
I'm pro-B, pro-butterfly. Yeah, keep them going.
You heard it here first, folks.
Austin, next week, we're finishing off, right?
War of the Planet of the Apes.
Awesome. You got some social media you want to shout out?
I do. I'm on Twitter. You can find me at Austin N. Rude, or you can find me at Old 2 Review, for those of you who are Doctor Who fans.
Cool.
And for you?
philrude.com, and you can get all our episode info there. You can buy art, and you can get my social media links there. I want to end this the same way we did last week, telling people, please get vaccinated. And Texans, please vote yourself some new leadership. You deserve much, much better than what you currently have. Tools for oppressing women and poor people have no place in any government. So go fuck yourself, Texas government. And
amen to
that.
And
let's bring in some better people. Oss, you got anything you want to add? You got any more anger you want to, as long as we're lashing out, anyone?
Yeah, sure. You know, everyone does need to get the vaccine, but pandas, please don't.
Yeah, don't vaccinate pandas, please.
They have bamboo, they're fine.
Panda flu. where are we in this show, Doc? Right, Austin, do you want to read the credits?
Sure. We did everything ourselves.
There you have it. We'll see you next time on the Picture Show.
See ya.
Greetings. I am Sav Chagrin, podcast guru and president of the Podfix Network. Since revealing myself as the puppeteer of the Podfix Nation, I have felt the need to be more hands-on with the day-to-day operations. Therefore, every Thursday, I will be opening the Podfix Archives, an absolute museum for your ears. And best of all, it is curated by none other than myself, Sav Chagrin, and no one else. I will be blowing the dust off my personally hand-pressed vinyl copies of original airings of classic Podfix Network episodes, uploading them to the satellites, and then rebroadcasting them to the masses. Sure, it's a lot of extra work, but one thing I have learned over the years is that digital media converted to vinyl converted back to digital is the way podcasts were meant to be heard. And since I, Sav Chagrin, have done all the heavy lifting for you, you just need to subscribe today to Podfix Presents wherever the best podcasts in the world are found. And then sit back, relax, and enjoy. The Podfix Network, artist owned and loved.